Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors and the second of a series of supplementary episodes published to commemorate important Tudor events. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk about the Battle of Bosworth is author and historian Chris Skidmore. Chris was educated at Bristol Grammar School and Christchurch, Oxford. He graduated in 2002 with a double first and was awarded a Gibbs Prize. Chris conducted postgraduate research at Oxford, where he was a convener of a graduate seminar on the Tudor nobility. Chris's first book, Edward VI, The Lost King of England, was published in 2007, followed by Death and the Virgin, an investigation into the mysterious death of Amy Robsart in 2010. Bosworth, The Birth of the Tudors, came out in 2013, and his latest book, Richard III, Brother, Protector, King, was published in 2017. My conversation with Chris, straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Chris.
Lovely to hear from you. Thanks very much for inviting me on.
Thank you. Could you share with us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, so my name's Chris Skidmore. I've been writing Tudor history now for just over 10 or so years. My first book was a biography of Edward VI. Right. That came out in 2007. I then published a book called Death and the Virgin, which was about Elizabeth I's relationship with Robert Dudley, in particular the death of Dudley's wife, Amy Robsart, and used a newly found coroner's report to show how Amy had sort of sustained certain injuries falling down the stairs. Mm-hmm. My third book was a book called On the Battle of Bosworth in 2010. And since then, I just recently published a full biography of Richard III. So I've sort of moved a bit back from the Tudors, and now I'm sort of can announce that actually I'm looking now at doing a full biography of Henry VII as my next project.
Oh, fantastic. That's exciting. And when do you think that'll be published?
Well, I mean, I used to take sort of 3 years to write a book, because I'm, for my sins, I'm also a member of Parliament. That's so sort of writing is my sort of my hobby, really, and sort of keeping me sane. Mm-hmm. But since sort of settling down, having kids, everything's slowed down a bit. So it's usually now, I think, 4 years. So I'm sort of my end date for publication, I'm hoping, will be January 2021.
Okay, well, that's exciting. And what sparked your interest in the Tudors?
Well, I think initially, to be honest with you, in the British A-level syllabus here, what we studied from 16 to 18, there was the opportunity to study the mid Tudor crisis, and sort of and I sort of got stuck in into that. And basically, when I got to university, I had sort of two passions. One was to again to look at Reformation history. Mm-hmm. I went to Christchurch, Oxford, had Christopher Haig as my tutor,
right.
And then Stephen Gunn became my doctoral supervisor. So I had some sort of fantastic Tudor specialists, yeah, who sort of really inspired me.
Right,
but when the choice came to, you know, looking at the Tudor period, for me, rather than going back too early or any later, it's that sort of perfect mix where you've got enough documentary evidence to sort of begin to shape people's personalities, their individual motivations, but not too much. So you're not swamped like if you studied, you know, the modern history, effectively, you're sampling.
Mm-hmm.
I like to have control of the sources I study. And if you go back too early, effectively you're sort of relying on archaeology, and it comes sort of you lose that sort of personal touch that sort of the Tudor age is able to have. So
I'd like to chat a little bit about the Battle of Bosworth. Obviously, this is a hugely important historical event that heralded the end of the Plantagenet dynasty and marked the birth of the Tudors. I'd like to begin with the actual battle site, which has been reassessed over the last decade. Could you talk to us a little bit about what we now know about where the battle actually took place?
Yeah, so for centuries, we sort of believed that the battle was fought around this place called Ambion Hill,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't too far from the village of Sutton Cheney in Leicestershire. And that's where, if you any visitors come to the battlefield site, it still has the sort of battlefield centre. But about, I don't know, 8 years ago now, they began sort of archaeologically surveying the battlefield site, which is very different from what it would have looked like at the time of the battle. You know, we've now got sort of hedges and trees and woods in sort of growing in the battlefield site in a place where it would have been plain land.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, this didn't just take place in one field.
No,
it takes place over sort of a, you know, several kilometres. And the study showed a sort of significant number of cannonballs being found scattered, and maybe 2 miles away from the site. And we'd always sort of known that the villages of Stoke, which is now called Stoke Golding, which is where Henry was crowned after the battle, and Dadlington, where there's a battlefield chapel where the dead are buried, was probably actually also quite close to the battlefield site. But the sort of the final sort of real piece of sort of evidence that showed that sort of a battle was fought about 2 miles away from the actual site where we think it was, in a place called Readmore, because the Battle of Bosworth was never called Bosworth to start with.
Yeah.
It was only called that 25 years later by the chronicler Robert Fabian.
Right.
It was actually called the Battle of Readmore, and R-E-D-E Moore. And we tried to find that site.
Mm.
And finally, the metal detectorists found a tiny silver gilt boar badge, and the boar is the symbol of Richard III, which suggests that one of his followers must have fallen, and quite a sort of high class follower would have fallen at sort of around that area. But it's sort of roughly on a there is a Roman road that runs all across this plain land, and it makes sense that the battle would have been fought along the Roman road, because in fact, you know, they brought a lot of artillery and weaponry, which would have sunk in the sort of marshy terrain if they didn't go along a road.
Fantastic. And do we know much about the size of the armies? Because I've read a lot of sort of differing accounts. So the size of the armies that fought for Richard and Henry that day?
Yeah, so you're right. There's about sort of five different versions the battle from various different sort of contemporary-ish sources. But they roughly agree that Richard's army was about twice to three times the size of Henry's. So Richard's between 10,000 to 15,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
The Crowland Chronicler, which was written a year after the battle in 1486, talks about Richard having the largest army ever gathered on one side.
Okay.
In contrast, we know that when Henry Tudor came over from France, you know, he sailed on the 1st of August 1485, landed in Milford Haven in Wales on the 7th of August. He had about 2,000 French mercenaries with him.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, it was a French invasion. It wasn't 1066, which was the last French invasion. It was Bosworth.
Yeah.
And about 500 English exiles. And he gathered a couple of men on the way.
Mm-hmm.
But probably at the most, you're looking at 5,000 men for Henry Tudor.
Goodness.
So when it comes to numbers alone, Richard should never have lost the Battle of Bosworth. You know,
absolutely.
He having sort of that strength in numbers should have delivered him the victory.
Absolutely. And what kind of weaponry and armour did these men have?
Well, there has been a bit of a debate around sort of weaponry and armor. We know that the contemporary sources talked about sort of Richard having cannons such as serpentines and bombards, which was, you know, huge cannons, all chained in a row. And we know, obviously, from the archaeological evidence that we have some significantly large cannonballs, right down to quite small size shot. You know, okay. We now have more cannonballs discovered at Bosworth than any other medieval battlefield, certainly sort of that early period, in any sort of European context. And the one thing we don't have is arrowheads. There must have been shots of arrows, but unlike the Battle of Towton, we haven't found those yet. And then also, you know, aside from the evidence that there was clearly sort of gunfire taking place, and we know also that the French mercenaries must have had a clear role to play in that. England hasn't really fought major battles for 20 years or so. And so you know, Henry Tudor and even Richard brought along Flemish gunners. We have payments for Flemish gunners in Richard III's accounts. That also the discovery of Richard III's body in the car park of Leicester in 2012 shows some of the wounds that would have probably been delivered by a halberdier, which is sort of having a very sharp axe-like instrument on a six-foot-long pole. There has been a big debate around Henry Tudor, whether he was surrounded by pikemen, which would be sort of these huge sort of 20-plus-foot-long wooden spiked poles, which are used by Swiss mercenaries. But I personally sort of doubt that was the case. It's difficult to see how those could have been transported across. And then you sort of look at other things with the usual instruments of war, I think, is what, you know, you'd imagine. So, you know, with swords, daggers, you'll be looking at possibly even sort of some kind of crossbows as well. I think sort of a full range. Whether they were handguns, some of the shot are quite small, which suggests that they may have been. But obviously in these days, handguns were often more of a hindrance than a help.
Wow, okay, thank you. Now, you talked about the size of the armies and the fact that Richard's army was significantly larger than Henry's. So I suppose the crucial question remains, what actually happened on the morning of 22nd August 1485? How did this virtually unknown Welshman manage to defeat the forces of King Richard III?
Well, it's a good question. And it's one that when I began to look at the battle and look at the different sources and sort of try to sort of break this down. I mean, one thing is that sort of when we look at the contemporary sources that exist, we can't absolutely guarantee what we read is what happened. The longest version of the Battle of Bosworth is by Polydore Vergil. And actually, I sort of think that he's possibly sort of constructed an imaginary battle scene based on sort of Roman sources such as Vegetius, which has been translated by the French author Christian de Pizan. And I look at that in my book on Bosworth, that actually to what extent that our record, you know, we are victims of the sources that we have, is actually sort of written later on, particularly by the Earl of Oxford, who is very influential and wants to put himself in the best light. But ultimately, you have to look at the fact that Richard is defeated not by Henry Tudor, who's never fought a battle. He's hiding at the back of the battlefield, surrounded by his men. You know, Richard's been a successful military general, has won at the battles of Barnet and Tewkesbury in the past. And he is defeated ultimately by his own side. When you look at the battle, it is deceit and treachery which leads to Richard's downfall, because out of those 15,000 or so men, 10,000-15,000 men, at least 6,000 of them don't actually engage in combat. So Richard's vanguard, the front line of his forces led by John Duke of Norfolk, for some reason collapses. That actually that Oxford on Henry Tudor's side, as the main general, manages to somehow turn the battle around and sort of and collapse the vanguard. And Richard's expecting that his rear guard, led by Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland, will charge into battle. And for some reason he doesn't. He stays still. And some have argued that perhaps there is a marsh in the way which prevents Northumberland from moving. But I sort of doubt that, because Richard would never have placed himself in that position to be boxed in. He had the choice of the lie of the land. He chose Ambion Hill to camp on, which is a hill, so he could see his enemy. And I don't think he would have placed himself in any disadvantaged situation to start with. it's more likely that Northumberland decides to turn against Richard. There's evidence from Polydore Vergil's manuscript account in the Vatican Library which suggests that Henry Tudor's already got in contact with Northumberland. They were childhood friends at Raglan in the 1460s. And Northumberland, having been a northern nobleman, was expecting rewards from Richard once he became king that he never got. Northumberland helped Richard to the throne. And I think it sort of bitter disappointment led Northumberland to sit on his hands.
Right, okay.
And then Richard effectively is forced then to join the battle by himself, which a king should never do. You know, a king as the leader of the army should always be commanding the battle, deciding on the strategy, but not actually participating in the battle himself.
Mm.
And Richard decides to make one last charge out of desperation. You know, it's out of bravery as well, but out of desperation that knowing he's got no alternative.
Goodness, yeah. All right, and in terms of the casualties, because again, I've read lots of different things there, what do the sources that we have tell us about the casualties that day?
So the casualties at Bosworth, relatively, are quite light, around about 1,000 men, which obviously sounds enormous nowadays and would be sort of, you know, headline news for weeks.
That's right.
But compared to, say, the Battle of Towton, which is the bloodiest on English soil, 28,000 men, you're looking at battles and Barnet and others of 5,000 men. So actually what seems to happen is that once Richard falls, his men quickly drop their armour.
Right,
you know, the king is dead, long live the king. As a result, there's a bit of a rout, but it's quite limited, and Henry Tudor decides not to chase after fleeing sort of Yorkists. As a result, you know, we don't see a huge casualty list.
Okay, and is it correct that Henry, in fact, backdated his reign? Is that right? So he could sort of hold that over the people that fought for Richard?
That's right, it's an interesting facet of Henry VII's character is his use of legislation throughout his reign. In order to tie people in, to bind them in through sort of enforced loyalty.
Yes, yeah.
So the Parliament of November 1485 dates his reign from the 21st of August, so that anyone technically fighting on Richard's side could automatically be declared a rebel.
Mm.
But, you know, it's interesting when you look at the calendar of Inquisition's post-mortem. You've got a list of people who mysteriously die on the 20th of August, 1485.
Oh, okay.
And one historian I noted saying, oh, maybe there was a skirmish that took place 2 days before the Battle of Bosworth. In fact, you know, people just bend the rules as they do nowadays.
Yes.
And a lot of people claim they died the day before Henry's reign started on the 21st of August.
Right, okay.
So people always will get around you know, the rules. And later on in the 1490s, Henry also passes another piece of legislation which says that if you don't turn up to fight for the king, you automatically will lose your lands that are given to you. Mm. And that hasn't happened before, but obviously Henry's learnt from Richard's example, which is that sort of you know a no-show is as bad as fighting against the king, and so he sort of ratchets that sort of these penalties up.
Right, okay. Now let's just talk about Richard for a second. So what many people think they know about Richard is quite heavily informed by Shakespeare's play of the same name, and the Tudor playwright has Richard in the heat of the battle cry out for a horse, of course, my kingdom for a horse. Is there any truth to this?
No, not at all. I mean, actually, it's the complete reverse.
Right, okay.
When you look at something, it's called Diego de Valera, who's a Spanish source, who again writes to Ferdinand Isabella a couple of months after the battle in 1486. He talks actually about Richard being offered a horse and Richard refusing the horse because sort of he can the battle is breaking down and it looks like Richard's going to lose. And so he's offered this horse to flee the battle, you know, in a very similar way that Warwick attempted to flee the Battle of Barnet in 1471. Richard actually refuses and say, no, this day I will die a king or win. And you know, places the crown on his helm, over his helmet, ready to charge into battle with 200 of his cavalrymen. And he does this because he sees that moment of deciding to do what make one final charge. It's almost like a second coronation. If he can finally defeat Henry Tudor, he will ultimately have God on his side, and all the decisions he's taken to seize the throne, what, you know, decide whatever happens to the princes in the tower, will always then be justified by God. And so, you know, he takes that gamble, and he doesn't take a horse at all.
Right, incredible. I wasn't going to ask you about the princes in the tower, but now that you've mentioned them, what's your feeling on that? What's your thought on the princes in the tower?
Well, partially, I mean, my new biography of Richard III, I didn't go completely in depth into the faith of the princes because ultimately, historically, it doesn't make a difference whether they are actually alive or dead because people believe that they are dead in 1483. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why you have this mass defection to Henry Tudor's cause because people genuinely believe the princes aren't coming out of the tower. Mm. You know, there seems to be this attempt to free them after Richard goes on a progress and then that seems to go wrong and men are arrested and former yeomen of the guard are executed. It seems that then ultimately while Richard is away, Buckingham I think comes back to London, and I personally would be of the mindset that the princes met their fate, whatever that fate was, at the Duke of Buckingham's hand. A chronicle that was discovered in 1981 in the College of Arms talks about how the princes were killed by the vise of the Duke of Buckingham.
Right.
And actually, when you look at Buckingham's rebellion, doesn't really make any sense. He joins that rebellion late in the day, and actually it seems that he's joining that rebellion as a reaction to finding out that people are sort of rebelling en masse and that he may be then sort of culpable for obviously the fate of the princes. But it seems around about sort of mid-August people begin to decide to rebel because someone called Giles Daubney, who's one of the main sort of rebels who joins Tudor's cause, puts all his lands in his wife's name, and you sort of can begin to see plotting emerge from there before it finally breaks out. Obviously I'm going to be looking at Perkin Warbeck as part of my new project, Henry VII, but you know, the key thing here is that probably Henry just didn't know whether Warbeck was or not the Prince Richard, the younger of the princes in the tower, and that's what you have to contend with. You may never solve the problem, but that fear and uncertainty and disinformation is, you know, a key part of medieval period, which makes people do crazy things. The reason why William Stanley decides, having helped Henry take the throne at Bosworth, then says, well, if Warbeck is Prince Richard, I'll have to back him. You know, he doesn't know. And that's also such a fascinating period, because people are so much like us in one respect, but so different.
Yeah, I agree with you. I often wonder at their ambition. It's hard to get my head around how ambitious people were, especially, you know, those close to the crown.
Yeah, and I think life was, you know, there was always that element of risk and a short life, and that meant that sort of people took risks and gambles that they ultimately were, the sense of power, though, you know, you were able to make enormous estates and enormous power bases if you got on the right side of the crown at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. So you talked about the cannonballs that were found on the battle site. I'm just wondering, have there been many other archaeological finds in the area?
So there's some really fascinating archaeological finds that were discovered 200, 300 years ago, not least the Bosworth crucifix, which is in the Society of Antiquaries. You know, it's a wonderful medieval cross that was supposedly processed as part of battlefield preparations. And it's a Yorkist cross, so got on Richard III's side. In terms of other finds, you have mentioned the Bosworth boar that's been found, the sort of gilt silver boar of Richard III. Okay. There's a couple of other sort of insignia that have been found on the battlefield site. A golden eagle with a snake in its mouth has been found, and they've been trying to sort of look at how or who they could date that to. There's been also some Burgundian coins. So evidence of actually those Burgundian troops I mentioned, probably on Richard III's side. You know, it's slender pickings in terms of what else has been found, but you know, that in itself I think provides us with enough information to be able to sort of piece together roughly where the battlefield was.
Have they found any remains, any skeletal remains or not?
So not on the battlefield site itself, but we know that the dead were moved to this battlefield chapel at Dadlington. And you can still go there. There's a lovely pub called the Dog and Hedgehog, and opposite is this church, which we know that Henry Tudor sort of set up, and then Henry VIII actually sort of financed and gave them a opportunity to raise money to pay for the chapel. And there is talk in sort of archaeological journals about how in the past people have found sort of, you know, actual mass grave sites, but they haven't actually done any excavations there. which I find fascinating. And I was speaking to someone who lives next door and saying he was just pulling out bones out of the ground. So I think there's huge potential at Dadlington to find the sort of mass graves of the dead at Bosworth. The other thing I also find remarkable and fascinating is that we know that Henry Tudor stayed at Merivale Abbey, which is a couple of miles a bit further east of the battlefield site, the night before the battle. And obviously the battle, the abbey was dissolved in the Reformation, but the Merivale church still survives. And in the church at the back is a stained glass, an original stained glass from Henry the VII's reign, which shows a picture of the saint, Saint Armel, who's a Breton saint. The only other image of Saint Armel is actually on Henry the VII's tomb in Westminster Abbey. And it seems that sort of actually, you know, alongside carrying the banners of St. George, he took Saint Armel with him as his sort of saint from his years in exile in Brittany. And he believes that sort of praying to Saint Armel may have saved him from drowning. And I find that fascinating because we can actually date the fact that Henry the VII came back to visit the battlefield area. We know from looking at sort of like his itinerary in 1503. And he must have donated that stained glass that's still there to this day in that sort of church.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. That's fantastic. I need to go and look that up after we finish talking. So despite popular thinking, the Battle of Bosworth wasn't actually the last battle of the Wars of the Roses, was it?
No. I mean, I guess it depends where you sort of pitch the end of the Wars of the Roses. But effectively, the Battle of Stoke in June 1487 is Henry's sort of last triumphant sort of battle, which then sort of really secures himself on the throne. John de la Pole of Suffolk and effectively tries to put Lambert Simnel on the throne, and they bring over 5,000 German mercenaries, this time paid for by Margaret of York, Richard III's sister, and that fails spectacularly, and it's quite a sharp short battle, and we think there's about 4,000 to 6,000 died in that battle, mainly on the opposing side. It was complete rout. But then also, I mean, I think when you look at things like the Cornish Rebellion in 1497 and Warbeck attempting to invade, then you could see that as one of the last
yeah,
battles. So I think sort of probably that's the last sort of pitched battle against the royal authority that sort of you could sort of put down to the Wars of the Roses. But the de la Poles, the White Rose faction, go on, and Suffolk, Edmund de la Pole, tries to go to Arkun, and eventually it's, you know, Richard de la Pole is still in exile and is killed at the Battle of Pavia in 1525, and Henry VIII rejoices. But, you know, William de la Pole is kept in prison for 38 years until he dies, and obviously we know Catherine de la Pole, who's a relation of George, Duke of Clarence's, is finally executed in 1543 at the age of 73.
So,
That goes on a lot. The threat is still there, but the I think 1497, I'd say, would be the final proper battle of the Wars of the Roses. That's where you end the date.
Fantastic. Now, we're coming to the end of our time, so I wanted to know if you were ready to play 10 to go, Chris.
Okay, yeah.
Give it a go. So, name two things that are on your bucket list.
Oh, my bucket list. to visit, I'd say, part of my research, I want to go to Bewley Abbey in Hampshire, which is where Warbeck was kept after he sort of invaded in 1497. And I actually want to go to Deal Beach in Kent, which is also where Warbeck tried to invade the first time in 1495, but his troops sort of cut down by Kentish villagers. So I'm planning my sort of visits about around the next book at the moment. So those are sort of two bucket list items that are sort of on my mind to go to.
Excellent. Fantastic. And what's one of your earliest childhood memories?
I mean, my earliest childhood memory is actually my brother being born. That's the one I can definitely date historically to actually, you know, I know that happened. Sometimes like with childhood memories, you can never be sure you were. So I'll go with that as my earliest childhood memory.
Fantastic. And what are you currently reading, or what's one of the books you're reading at the moment?
So what have I got on my desk? I've got a variety of things, political and sort of historical. So I'm actually reading sort of Power Broker, by Robert Caro, who I'm a big
Okay.
fan of.
Right.
He writes usually books on Lyndon Johnson, but this is about Robert Moses and the creation of New York. And I've also got the Perkin Warbeck Conspiracy by Ian Arthurson, which I've
Okay.
reread. It's sort of rereading it, as it were, because it's such a detailed book.
Okay, there's one to
Yeah,
add
it's
to the
a
list.
treasure trove of source material in the index. I tend to find that when I read Tudor books, I spend more time in the index looking at
That's so
the
true.
sources.
Very true. All right, fantastic. What's a favourite holiday destination?
Favorite holiday destination? Well, actually, I'm going on holiday
Oh,
tomorrow,
that's right. Yes,
and so I'm going back to a country that I think is probably my favorite, which is Italy,
Oh,
in
lovely.
terms of the food and opportunity to sightsee. So yeah, we'll be off to Pisa
Oh,
and various other
fantastic.
places around Florence. So I'll go for
Go with
Italy and
Italy?
stay
All
with this
right,
weather.
lucky you.
Yeah.
That sounds good. What's one of your biggest pet peeves?
Pet
What's
peeves.
something that annoys you?
Ooh, something which annoys me. Organization, I guess. I guess that's sort of I'm rubbish at sort of
Okay.
paperwork,
Right, yes.
and generally sort of everything you need to run a household properly. I'd much prefer to spend my time reading historical books than living in the sort of present and dealing with everything that needs to be done.
Okay, all right, that's good. What was your first paid job?
My first paid job, actually, the first money I got for a job was actually quite an unusual one. I worked as an intern at the People magazine,
Oh,
which I
okay.
think is exists in Australia as I
Yes,
can't think what the
as
title is.
Who magazine?
Who? Who magazine? Yeah. So actually, I had a couple of bylines in that, and I think that was going back to about 2002.
Right,
It was
okay.
actually my sort of so I remember going to launch the sort of new Kylie Minogue
Right.
waxwork at Madame Tussauds and having to write about that, and I think that appeared in Who magazine as well.
Right, okay.
So somewhere, yeah, I've got a byline which I was very proud of at the time, but I decided not to go into journalism.
Into
But
journalism. Okay. And interestingly, my sister's only just finished up as senior editor at Who for about 20 something years. So there you go.
okay.
There's a connection. What's your favourite form of exercise?
Favorite form of exercise,
Is there
I
a favourite
would.
form of exercise?
Well, I think my sort of in terms of what little exercise I get, walking the dog, and if I ever get the chance to play sport, it would be is tennis or skiing.
Okay,
But
awesome.
skiing's obviously pretty limited in the UK.
Yeah. All right, good, excellent. What's one book that you think everyone should read? If you could get everyone to read one book, what would
Ooh, everyone to read a book in the Tudor period, or sort of
Oh,
just
we
full
can.
stop.
Just whatever. Yeah, Tudor or not Tudor, that's fine.
Oh, it's a difficult one actually. In terms of, I think probably my favourite book of all time, which I would try, I evangelise about, is a German writer called W.G. Sebald.
Okay.
And I'm a big fan of his books, Rings of Saturn, Emigrants, but I'd probably say Austerlitz
Okay.
is a fantastic book, which I don't know how he wrote it. It's just wonderful.
All right, fantastic. And last question, what is your drink of choice?
Drink of choice, alcoholic, non-alcoholic.
Let's go
I think
alcoholic.
let's go
Let's
alcoholic.
go
I'm a
alcoholic.
bit of I'm a whiskey fan,
Are
so
you
single malt
okay?
whiskies,
All right.
Lagavulin, Lafroig, mainly from the Isle of Islay.
Okay.
And so that's another non-historical bucket list, is eventually to go to Islay on the west coast of Scotland to visit the distilleries there. So
Fantastic.
yeah, I think sort of penchant for whiskey.
Sounds good. Now, final question that I ask all my guests is for now, you've actually given us lots of interesting Tudor bits and pieces to go and have a look at, but do you have a final Tudor takeaway? So, something for listeners to go off and explore, might be a website, might be to read a book, anything at all.
So I've got. Can I give you two Tudor
Oh,
takeaways, if
yes,
that's all right?
please.
So,
Love.
basically, one site I use an awful lot, which is indispensable when you can't always get to the archives,
Yep.
is a site called AALT.org, which is Anglo-American Legal Tradition,
Okay.
and they have scanned, taken photos of thousands, if not nearly approaching millions, of documents in the National Archives in Kew.
Wow, okay.
And
That's
you can
fantastic.
just go on the website and load up the photos, and can be a real sort of time saver if you just want to check a document. It's not everything is there, but I don't think many people know about it. It's run, I think, from the University of Kansas. And when I go to the archives, there's always someone there just taking page after page after page, But, you know, if you're interested in looking at sort of documents, Chancery record, Exchequer records,
yes.
You know, I'm passionate about the fact that we still live in an age where we can find original source, you know, new facts in the original material.
Absolutely.
There's that website. And then I'd also say, you know, you can't be getting back to the original sources in terms of reading. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to looking at sort of Bosworth, when it comes to looking at Henry VII, I'd say, you know, Polydore Vergil's mm-hmm. Anglia Historia is a key text, and I would say certainly that, you know, it's published by Dennis Hay in 1950. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you just can't beat that, getting back to those originals.
That's fantastic. I love your takeaways. Thank you so much. Chris, this has been so great. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for joining me on Talking Tudors, and I look forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you, Natalie.
Have a wonderful holiday anytime. As well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.